Books on Tape
and Infants on Thrones
presents A Short History of Nearly Everything by Bill Bryson.
With commentary, analysis, feedback, and general bullshitting by Infants on Thrones panelists and maybe even you.
Read by Richard Matthews.
Quite expertly, I might add. Love this guy's voice. Just love it.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and I have an idea. And I'm going to pitch it to you, our listeners, and to my fellow infant panelists pretty much at the same time, using this minisode as a prototype so that I can show instead of just tell you what I'm thinking that I want to do with this. Because this sort of inspired me, and maybe it will inspire you too. But first, I'd like to welcome you here. And I'd like to offer my congratulations that you're here to listen to this today.
Welcome, and congratulations.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I just said.
I'm delighted that you could make it. Getting here wasn't easy, I know. In fact, I suspect it was a little tougher than you realize. To begin with, for you to be here now, trillions of drifting atoms had somehow to assemble in an intricate and intriguingly obliging manner to create you. It's an arrangement so specialized and particular that it has never been tried before, and will only exist this once. For the next many years, we hope, these tiny particles will uncomplainingly engage in all the billions of deft, cooperative efforts necessary to keep you intact, and let you experience the supremely agreeable but generally underappreciated state known as existence.
So here's my idea. Here's what I want to do. I want to do a deep dive commentary on this book, A Short History of Nearly Everything, which, you know, short history of nearly everything acronym, it's shown. So we could be like Infants on Shown for this one. Or so, you know, I mean, we could. I'm just saying we could. And it's also kind of like Shinha, if it helps, you know, from the Book of Abraham. That Shinha is the real name of the real son, according to, you know, the real father Abraham. Now, he didn't know about atoms. Even Joseph Smith didn't know about atoms. Now, he talked about these things called intelligences, and back when I was a believing Mormon, I thought, well, maybe intelligences are atoms. Who knows? But, you know, that was way back when I let faith fill in the gap of things that I didn't really understand, and I was fine to not explore that anymore because faith filled the space. But, you know, obviously, that's not where I am now, and probably those of you listening, you're not there either. But if we're honest with ourselves, faith still has to play a role because we don't know everything. In fact, we really don't know most things. And that's one of the things that I absolutely love about this book, is that it showed me just how much I really don't know, how much most people really don't know, because, you know, we're all atoms, right? We're all these lifeless building blocks that have combined and worked together and coordinate somehow to make life. How does this happen? I mean, you can understand why people would think that there is an intelligent designer out there that's making that happen, because it's really amazing, and maybe it is an actual miracle that this happens. But why do they? Why do atoms even come together in the way that they've come together to make us? Now, these are the kinds of questions that really kept me grounded in Mormonism for as long as I was, because I felt like I had special access to God knowledge. But, you know, come on, there's too many problems with that to even get into right now. But the truth is that no one really knows why atoms do this. It's a mystery that's still out there to be solved. And that promise of further light and knowledge, well, that was something that I also really loved about Mormonism. And now that I no longer live my life according to Mormon belief, I've kind of tossed that sense of mystery out with it. But I don't have to, because there's still plenty of mystery about the universe, about existence, about life. And science also offers the promise of further light and knowledge, like Mormonism did for me, but in a far, far more superior way.
I don't know why you always have to be judging me, because I only believe in science.
Why atoms take this trouble is a bit of a puzzle. Being you is not a gratifying experience at the atomic level. For all their devoted attention, your atoms don't actually care about you. Indeed, don't even know that you are there. They don't even know that they are there. They are mindless particles, after all, and not even themselves alive. It is a slightly arresting notion that if you were to pick yourself apart with tweezers, one atom at a time, you would produce a mound of fine atomic dust, none of which had ever been alive, but all of which had once been you. Yet somehow, for the period of your existence, they will answer to a single, overarching impulse, to keep you, you.
I just find that so compelling, so amazing. And it raises so many questions that I don't have answers to, but I want to try to learn as much about it as I can. So now I first listened to this audiobook probably back in 2008 when I bought it. And it's interesting because I started listening to it again recently and realized there's things that I believed that came from this book, and I didn't realize that they came from this book until I listened to it again. So, like, if you think about the bonus General Conference episode where we had listener content, there were a few little throwaway things that I put in there, and one of them was this member mailbag thing where this guy is asking a question about atoms, and he's asking a question about the Big Bang, and does the Big Bang expand and then contract and expand and contract, and is it like this eternal process of expanding and contracting? I got that idea, I think, from this book, and I've just been carrying it around with me for so many years I forgot it. So you know, we've been doing what? Infants on Thrones for how many years? We're going on our fifth year now, I think. We've been doing it for four, and we've always talked about this as being self-discovery, you know, things that we're interested in, that we have these conversations about. And, you know, so as our interests shift and evolve, then the content of what we do will shift and evolve. And I think if you've been listening to us for the 4 years we've been doing this, you probably heard some shifts. Hopefully this will become another one of those shifts, because what I want to do is take a really deep dive into this book and share it with you so that you get to hear, as listeners, you get to hear as much of the audiobook as you can, but you also get to hear the infant insights as we're listening to this and our minds are being blown, and we're also asking questions. And we may be doing some panel discussions with this, or it may be something where we record our own responses to it and put it together in some kind of a compilation. Exactly how it's going to work out, I still don't know, but it'll be something kind of like this. And what I do want to say, because I know people ask these questions every once in a while about the music that we use or different clips that we use that I'd pull from YouTube or other things. So I want to talk about copyright issues, because I do not own the copyright to this book. But there is a thing called fair use. And fair use looks at four principles. And if you're able to fall within any of these four principles, you're probably okay for fair use. So the first is that the purpose and character of the use, including whether such use is of commercial nature or is for a nonprofit educational purposes. So I think we're pretty good there, because this is not a commercial venture, Infants on Thrones. This is definitely for, educational, maybe educational. It is a nonprofit in that we don't ask for money. We don't collect money unless we're selling like t-shirts or something. But it is educational. And I think the purpose of this, doing this episode this way, or this series, is for educational purposes. So I think we're okay there. And then the nature of the copyrighted work. You know, this is a book. It's a long book. We're going to be using most, if not all of it, or at least that's my vision for it. So that could be a little bit problematic. And then number three speaks to that as well, the amount and the sustainability of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole. And then the fourth one is the effect of the use upon the potential market for or value of the copyrighted work. So this book was written back in 2005, 2006. It's been around for a while. I don't think that what we're doing on Infants on Thrones is going to impact its marketability at this point. In fact, what I would say is I would recommend any of you who are interested in it go out and buy it and you can listen along or you can read it. I've got a version on my Kindle as well. So go and get it. But I think as long as we're commenting on it, and this recording, this audiobook, becomes a springboard for ideas and questions and discussions that not only I have, but other infants who are interested in this will also have. And then if there are listeners, there are people out there in this listening audience that absolutely know way more about this stuff than I do. And so I'd love to hear from you. And even the people that don't really know and haven't really studied but have questions, I'd love to hear those questions as well. And we may be able to set up a way that you're able to contribute in the way that we contribute in putting this together. So I think that's something that will kind of evolve over time doing this. I expect this is going to be kind of a mini-sode that is published in infrequent installments, kind of like the Book of Abraham thing that I've done, where I've got 3 chapters done already, 2 more to go. And then, why not go into Moses? Why not do this with other scripture things? I kind of like the approach that I've taken with the Book of Abraham. So if we establish a way of approaching a book like this, Short History of Nearly Everything, maybe it's something that could become a permanent feature of Infants on Thrones, or maybe it's something that'll just die out like other things that we try, and it doesn't really work. It takes a lot of time. So anyway, that's what this might be. I said might.
The bad news is that atoms are fickle, and their time of devotion is fleeting, fleeting indeed. Even a long human life adds up to only about 650,000 hours. And when that modest milestone flashes past, or at some other point thereabouts, for reasons unknown, your atoms will shut you down, silently disassemble, and go off to be other things.
Our atoms are going to go off to be other things, which means that they've already been other things before they were us. What does that mean? And it makes me wonder. And so a lot of these questions that I have from this obviously come out of my Mormon background and my Mormon framed mind. But so is there actually something to being good, being righteous, following commandments or something? Is it possible that the things that we do during these however many hours it is that he said that we're alive, is it possible that those make some kind of an impact or an imprint at the atomic level? And so that even though these atoms disassemble and they go off to become other things, are they fundamentally changed or altered or influenced in any way by the time that they spent as us or not? I don't know the answer to that. It's just a question. It's just an example of some of the questions that you'll hear from me as we listen to this audiobook together. And fair warning to the Randy Snyders out there who are going to go, oh no, that doesn't happen. You can say that, and you can take like a hard line on, oh no, it's absolutely impossible. I'm not going to believe you, because one of the things that I love about this book is that it shows us how recent our understanding even is. Just life itself, our lives itself are such an small. I'll go with small. A little Porky Pig moment there. It's just a little small moment in the whole cosmic time. And of that small moment in time, how much have we even had the tools to explore our universe that we are now? So we're always discovering new things and correcting assumptions that we had before. So, I'll pose a question like I just did about atoms. Do we actually impact it? And does that then go on to impact whatever they become next, whether that's a living being or not? So do we have a responsibility? Do I have a responsibility to really take care of my atoms so that I return them? It's like when you go camping and you say, return the campsite to at least as good as it was before you went there. Do I have the same responsibility with my atoms that way? And is there even a way of knowing that right now? We may not have a way of knowing, or maybe we do have a way of knowing and I'm just ignorant of it. But anyway, these are the kinds of questions right here, right like that. Is that interesting to you? It's interesting to me. Is it interesting to you? It's interesting to me.
And that's it for you. Still, you may rejoice that it happens at all. Generally speaking, in the universe, it doesn't, so far as we can tell. This is decidedly odd, because the atoms that so liberally and congenially flock together to form living things on Earth are exactly the same atoms that decline to do it elsewhere. Whatever else it may be, at the level of chemistry, life is curiously mundane. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, a little calcium, a dash of sulfur, a light dusting of other very ordinary elements, nothing you wouldn't find in any ordinary drugstore, and that's all you need. The only thing special about the atoms that make you is that they make you. That is, of course, the miracle of life.
So what? One of the first conversations that I had with Scott, I think, back when he was going by Jesse, when we started Infants on Thrones, he was talking about materialism versus dualism. And I had never heard of that concept before, where materialists are focused just on what you can observe. And I know I'm going to get this wrong. People are going to say, you're getting it wrong, whatever. I'm going to say it wrong. Let's just accept that. And dualism is more if there's like a spirit. You know, so a materialist would say everything that's going on in your body is just a function of your brain. A dualist would say, well, there's a spirit that animates your body. Okay, maybe I got that a little bit wrong, but that was such an interesting thing for me to learn in having this conversation with Scott. And so now I'm kind of in the same place, wondering with what Bill Bryson has written here in A Short History of Nearly Everything, what is it that actually forms life? You know, so you've got he talked about the drugstore that you could go and, you know, a little bit of carbon, a dash of this and that. At what point do these atoms that come together, you know, because I'm sitting on a chair, I'm sitting at a desk, I've got a microphone in front of me, a computer, they're all made up of atoms, the same type of atoms that make me up, but I'm alive and they're not alive. And what is it that gives me the consciousness, that gives me memory, that gives me awareness? See, now we're getting into some Westworld themes, huh? You know, that television show is awesome. This is all hitting me at the same time. But what is life and consciousness and all these things? Can it be? I think it must be material. It's got to be explained in a materialist type of way. But I can understand why dualists would approach it the way that they do, because there is something different about it than the chair, the desk, the microphone in front of me.
Whether or not atoms make life in other corners of the universe, they make plenty else. Indeed, they make everything else. Without them, there would be no water or air or rocks, no stars and planets, no distant gassy clouds or swirling nebulae, or any of the other things that make the universe so usefully material. Atoms are so numerous and necessary that we easily overlook that they needn't actually exist at all. There is no law that requires the universe to fill itself with small particles of matter, or to produce light and gravity and the other physical properties on which our existence hinges. There needn't actually be a universe at all. For the longest time, there wasn't. There were no atoms and no universe for them to float about in. There was nothing. Nothing at all, anywhere.
Yeah, I find this a little hard to accept. And again, maybe it's my Mormon upbringing here, but how do we know? How do we know that there was nothing? How do we not know that there was always atoms, you know, or there are always universes, and it's always, you know, this expand, contract, and the things that makes atoms and makes the universe? I don't know. I don't know how we know that. Did any of you? How do we know that? How do we know that there was nothing? Can't see it.
So thank goodness for atoms. But the fact that you have atoms, and that they assemble in such a willing manner, is only part of what got you here. To be here now, alive in the 21st century and smart enough to know it, you also had to be the beneficiary of an extraordinary string of biological good fortune. Survival on Earth is a surprisingly tricky business. Of the billions and billions of species of living thing that have existed since the dawn of time, most, 99.99%, are no longer around. Life on Earth, you see, is not only brief, but dismayingly tenuous. It is a curious feature of our existence that we come from a planet that is very good at promoting life, but even better at extinguishing it.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to articulate this very well, but this is a thought that I've had for a long time. And it's a question, really, that, again, I don't have any answers to. But when you think about the probability of life existing and of you who's listening to this, me who's saying this, of us actually being here, all of the different things that had to happen, it is very easy to then go, oh, well, it would be impossible without a creator. You know, there would have to be a God that actually willed this, because otherwise, statistically, it's just this very tiny chance that you could have conditions so perfect on a planet with the distance it is from the sun and, you know, blah, 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 that it would evolve into us, these conscious, sentient beings. But even if there is, like, a 0.00001% probability that this is going to happen, there still is. You know, it's kind of like that Jim Carrey line.
What are my chances?
Not good.
You mean not good, like, 1 out of 100?
I'd say more like 1 out of 1,000,000.
So you're telling me there's a chance?
Yeah!
So you're saying I've got a chance. There's still a chance, and if that exists somewhere, why not here? Why not us being that is the chance that comes from? So, like, I can understand the appeal of a creator, but it's not necessary. And the other thing that I think is interesting, when you pair this with evolution, that it's not just that conditions on this earth were perfect for us, it's that the conditions on this earth created us, they formed us. And the reason that we are the way that we are right now is because of the conditions that were on this earth. And if there are other earths, other planets that have life on it, then the life on those planets will be a result of the conditions of that planet and that earth. And that's one of those things that, you know, science fiction has a lot of fun exploring. Anyway, the improbability of us existing in the universe creates more of a sense of awe for me than feeling like I am a child of God ever did. And that right there is as good a revisionist, post hoc, narrativizing history as you're ever going to see. You're welcome.
The average species on Earth lasts for only about 4 million years. So if you wish to be around for billions of years, you must be as fickle as the atoms that made you. You must be prepared to change everything about yourself. Shape, size, color, species affiliation, everything. And to do so repeatedly. That's much easier said than done, because the process of change is random. To get from protoplasmal primordial atomic globule, as the Gilbert and Sullivan song put it, to sentient, upright modern human, has required you to mutate new traits over and over in a precisely timely manner for an exceedingly long while. So at various periods over the last 3.8 billion years, you have abhorred oxygen and then doted on it, grown fins and limbs and jaunty sails, laid eggs, flicked the air with a forked tongue, been sleek, been furry, lived underground, lived in trees, been as big as a deer and as small as a mouse, and a million things more. The tiniest deviation from any of these evolutionary shifts, and you might now be licking algae from cave walls, or lolling walrus-like on some stony shore, or disgorging air through a blowhole in the top of your head before diving 60 feet for a mouthful of delicious sandworms.
Not that there's anything wrong with eating sandworms. I mean, if that's your thing, or if you like to blow air through a hole, you know, go ahead, do what you've got to do. But the point is that we evolved based on the conditions of this earth. And I don't know, does it make you wonder? Do you wonder if any of the atoms that are in your body actually were part of these different stages of evolution that he talked about here? So, like, maybe parts of you were a mollusk or, you know, some of these other things. And at the atomic level, is there any kind of, like, memory or instinct or anything like that that would then carry to you that could possibly explain why you do some of the incredibly odd and awkward, unmentionable things that you do? I mean, maybe it goes back to the mollusk days. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows?
The bonobos. The bonobos know. Okay, it's the bonobos.
Not only have you been lucky enough to be attached since time immemorial to a favored evolutionary line, but you have also been extremely, make that miraculously fortunate in your personal ancestry. Consider the fact that for 3.8 billion years, a period of time older than the Earth's mountains and rivers and oceans, every one of your forebears on both sides has been attractive enough to find a mate, healthy enough to reproduce, and sufficiently blessed by fate and circumstances to live long enough to do so. Not one of your pertinent ancestors was squashed, devoured, drowned, starved, stranded, stuck fast, untimely wounded, or otherwise deflected from its life's quest of delivering a tiny charge of genetic material to the right partner at the right moment in order to perpetuate the only possible sequence of hereditary combinations that could result, eventually, astoundingly, and all too briefly, in you.
Hang on a second. We got to hear that again because that was hot.
Hi, this is Ron Jeremy. You're listening to Porno Sonic.
Life's quest of delivering a tiny charge of genetic material to the right partner at the right moment in order to perpetuate the only possible sequence of hereditary combinations that could result, eventually, astoundingly, and all too briefly, in you.
That's hot. That is really hot.
This is a book about how it happened. In particular, how we went from there being nothing at all to there being something. And then how a little of that something turned into us. And also some of what happened in between and since. There's a great deal to cover, of course, which is why the book is called A Short History of Nearly Everything, even though it isn't really. It couldn't be. But with luck, by the time we finish, it will feel as if it is.
Yeah, especially if we do this together in kind of an innovative and creative way through Infants on Thrones. That's hot.
My own starting point, for what it's worth, was an illustrated science book that I had as a classroom text when I was in the fourth or fifth grade. The book was a standard-issue 1950s schoolbook, battered, unloved, grimly hefty. But near the front, it had an illustration that just captivated me. A cutaway diagram showing the Earth's interior as it would look if you cut into the planet with a large knife and carefully withdrew a wedge representing about a quarter of its bulk.
Let me tell you a little bit about the author of this book. His name is Bill Bryson. Born December 8th, 1951. He's a best-selling Anglo-American author of books on travel, the English language, science, and other non-fiction topics. He was born in the United States. He's been a resident of Britain for most of his adult life, returning to America between 1995 and 2003. He served as the Chancellor of Durham University from 2005 to 2011, and he came to prominence in the United Kingdom with the publication of Notes from a Small Island in 1995, an exploration of Britain and its accompanying television series. And then he received widespread recognition again with the publication of this book, A Short History of Nearly Everything, in 2003, a book widely acclaimed for its accessible communication of science. And that's the point. He makes it accessible. So Bill Bryson is not himself a scientist, but he studied for 3 years because of his fascination and interest that he's explaining here that came from his childhood. And then also a recognition that there aren't really a lot of ways of conveying this information that are interesting. And so it makes science seem kind of dull when science isn't dull, but it's the delivery method that's dull. So maybe he would actually approve, hopefully, of what we're doing with Infants on Thrones. But let's listen to the rest of his story.
It's hard to believe that there was ever a time when I had not seen such an illustration before. But evidently I had not, for I clearly remember being transfixed. I suspect, in honesty, my initial interest was based on a private image of streams of unsuspecting eastbound motorists in the American Plains states plunging over the edge of a sudden 4,000-mile-high cliff running between Central America and the North Pole. But gradually my attention did turn in a more scholarly manner to the scientific import of the drawing, and the realization that the Earth consisted of discrete layers, ending in the center with a glowing sphere of iron and nickel, which was as hot as the surface of the sun, according to the caption, and I remember thinking with real wonder, how do they know that? I didn't doubt the correctness of the information for an instant. I still tend to trust the pronouncements of scientists in the way I trust those of surgeons, plumbers, and other possessors of arcane and privileged information. But I couldn't for the life of me conceive how any human mind could work out what spaces thousands of miles below us that no eye had ever seen and no X-ray could penetrate could look like and be made of. To me, that was just a miracle. That has been my position with science ever since. Excited, I took the book home that night and opened it before dinner, an action that I expect prompted my mother to feel my forehead and ask if I was all right. And, starting with the first page, I read. And here's the thing. It wasn't exciting at all. It wasn't actually altogether comprehensible. Above all, it didn't answer any of the questions that the illustration stirred up in a normal inquiring mind. How did we end up with a sun in the middle of our planet? And if it is burning away down there, why isn't the ground under our feet hot to the touch? And why isn't the rest of the interior melting? Or is it? And when the core at last burns itself out, will some of the earth slump into the void, leaving a giant sinkhole on the surface? And how do you know this? How did you figure it out?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that he got down on his knees and he said a prayer and he got a really warm confirmation in his heart, and that's how the man knew about the contents of the earth, right? Or maybe he actually even saw a vision, you know, of an angel or something like that. But it was probably something like that. It was the reason that he knew was because a divine being told him. That's going to be my guess. Let's see.
But the author was strangely silent on such details.
Probably because he didn't want to be persecuted like Joseph Smith was. Yeah, that makes sense. That totally makes sense. I was right. Again.
Indeed, silent on everything but anticlines, synclines, axial faults, and the like. It was as if he wanted to keep the good stuff secret by making all of it soberly unfathomable. As the years passed, I began to suspect that this was not altogether a private impulse. There seemed to be a mystifying universal conspiracy among textbook authors to make certain the material they dealt with never strayed too near the realm of the mildly interesting and was always at least a long-distance phone call from the frankly interesting.
Yeah, a long-distance collect phone call. I got your back, Bill.
I now know that there is a happy abundance of science writers who pen the most lucid and thrilling prose. Timothy Ferris, Richard Forte, and Tim Flannery are three that jump out from a single station of the alphabet, and that's not even to mention the late but godlike Richard Feynman. But sadly, none of them wrote any textbook I ever used. All mine were written by men, it was always men, who held the interesting notion that everything became clear when expressed as a formula.
Or with a Venn diagram, or maybe some kind of like a cred scale, maybe.
And the amusingly deluded belief that the children of America would appreciate having chapters end with a section of questions they could mull over in their own time. So I grew up convinced that science was supremely dull, but suspecting that it needn't be, and not really thinking about it at all if I could help it. This, too, became my position for a long time. Then, much later, about 4 or 5 years ago, I was on a long flight across the Pacific, staring idly out the window on lit ocean, when it occurred to me with a certain uncomfortable forcefulness that I didn't know the first thing about the only planet I was ever going to live on. I had no idea, for example, why the oceans were salty, but the Great Lakes weren't. Didn't have the faintest idea. I didn't know if the oceans were growing more salty with time or less, and whether ocean salinity levels were something I should be concerned about or not. I'm very pleased to tell you that until the late 1970s, scientists didn't know the answers to these questions either. They just didn't talk about it very audibly. And ocean salinity, of course, represented only the merest sliver of my ignorance. I didn't know what a proton was, or a protein, didn't know a quark from a quasar, didn't understand how geologists could look at a layer of rock on a canyon wall and tell you how old it was, didn't know anything, really. I became gripped by a quiet, unwanted urge to know a little about these matters, and to understand how people figured them out. That, to me, remained the greatest of all amazements, how scientists work things out. How does anybody know how much the Earth weighs, or how old its rocks are, or what really is way down there in the center? How can they know how and when the universe started, and what it was like when it did? How do they know what goes on inside an atom, and how, come to that, or perhaps above all, can scientists so often seem to know nearly everything, but then still can't predict an earthquake, or even tell us whether we should take an umbrella with us to the races next Wednesday? So I decided that I would devote a portion of my life, 3 years as it now turns out, to reading books and journals and finding saintly, patient experts prepared to answer a lot of outstandingly dumb questions. The idea was to see if it isn't possible to understand and appreciate, marvel at, enjoy even, the wonder and accomplishments of science at a level that isn't too technical or demanding, but isn't entirely superficial either. That was my idea and my hope, and that is what the book that follows is intended to be.
And hopefully what this podcast series of Infants on Thrones will continue with this group of people interacting with each other somehow, some way. So, this does it for today's episode, and, I want to ask you, is this something that would be interesting to you? Do you want to hear something like this on Infants on Thrones? So if you could comment on the website, send us an email at infantsonthrones@gmail.com. That's our email address. Or if you look me up, find me on Facebook, you want to say something to me directly, you can message me on Facebook. But I'm curious to know, am I the only one that's interested in this? And then I'll also talk with my fellow infants and see if this is something that they would be interested in doing as well. It takes a lot of work, sitting here and listening to this and then commenting and trying to make things tie together a little bit. But I think that it's something that we could do. The payoff's certainly worth it. There are some risks, I guess, on the copyright side. Like I said, I think fair use covers us for this. But, worst case scenario, we would be contacted by somebody and they would say, take it down. And we would take it down. But the work that it takes to create this only helps me understand it and learn it better. So I'm willing to take that risk. And I think for you as listeners and consumers, and hopefully if we find a way, maybe like listener essays or something like that, where you guys can contribute to your voice as well, that would be a super cool thing, I think. So anyway, this is an idea that I have, and I want to know what you guys think about it. And I say these things in the way that I just did right now.
Hi, this is Brian from Novi, Michigan, and I am yet another return missionary from Japan who has left the church. Konnichiwa, guden senpai! You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, give the quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. Anyone for the closing prayer?
To be close, to be here with you, and now with all my heart, I will lay down precisely at your feet.
Thank you for listening to
Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.